Welcome back to End of the Word. We dropped off last time in the middle of a section in the book of Leviticus, chapter 27, which is dedicated to vows, promises made in the name of God, particularly promises made to God on behalf of the priesthood, the ministry of God. And the thing that we were looking at starting in verse 16, is if a person vows the use of his inheritance, his land, to the priesthood, to the Levites, to let them work the land, then he changes his mind. He decides, you know, I really need to get that property back, whatever the reason. These are the rules for how to do that. Now remember that land is valued not intrinsically, but based on how much production comes out of that land. And so that comes out in this part of Leviticus. Leviticus 27:16. If a man dedicates to he who is part of the land that is his possession. So everybody, when they go into the promised land, each adult male is going to receive an inherited area of the promised land. And then that will be divided up amongst his heirs, and then those heirs will divide up amongst their heirs. And over time, you know, the same piece of property stays in the same family lineage. And at the end of every 50 years, called the Jubilee year, that property all goes back into the control of the lineage of that family. It never passes out of the tribe or out of that family. But it's the production of the land that gives it its value, because the land belongs to God. The earth or the land is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. So, effectively, the Jewish people are tenants. The Israelis are tenants working the land of God. And the production of that land is the value of it. So, this shall be the valuation in proportion to its seed. A homer of barley seed shall be valued at 50 shekels of silver. A piece of land is producing an omer of barley seed, or six bushels of barley seed, then that piece of property is worth 50 shekels of silver, about 100 days' wages. Now, that's just the example. That's the baseline. Verse 17, if he, meaning the owner, dedicates his field from the year of Jubilee, then the valuation shall stand. So, you take the entirety of 50 years, well, the working years of 50 years, because remember, you've got seven cycles of 6 years of work. Actually, the first cycle is only 5 years of work, because the first year of the next Jubilee cycle is also a Jubilee year. So you take all of those work years for the land, and you multiply that times their yearly valuation. That's how much that piece of property is worth. That's what we're learning here. So if he dedicates his field from the year of Jubilee, then the valuation shall stand. So that's the full value. But if he dedicates his field after the Jubilee, so at some point thereafter, then the priest shall calculate the price according to the years that remain until the year of Jubilee. So basically, if you're already partway through the 50-year cycle, then you have to figure out how many work years. That's the multiplier for the valuation of the land lease at that point. And so a deduction shall be made from the valuation. If he who dedicates the field wishes to redeem it, no matter where it is in the cycle, then he's going to add a fifth or 20% to its valuation price, and it shall remain his. So if he's leased his property to the Levites, and then for some reason he wants to bring the property back under his own control, he goes to the Levites and says, okay, there's 30 years left in the Jubilee cycle. This is the standard year-by-year valuation for the work years. Let's multiply it. I'll add 20% to that total, and that's what I'm going to pay you in silver so that I can have the property back, and that's fair. The vow is now fulfilled because he redeemed the property with silver. Now, verse 20 says, if he does not wish to redeem the field, meaning maybe he doesn't have the cash, or if he has sold the field to another man, it shall not be redeemed anymore. So if he's given it to somebody else, pass the land lease on to somebody else, but it didn't involve a vow, then he and that guy are going to have to work it out. They don't have to give it back to him, I don't believe. Basically, he just has to wait if he's not able to invoke a redemption right. Verse 21, but the field, when it is released in the Jubilee, shall be a holy gift to he who is, like a field that has been devoted. The priest shall be in possession of it. Now, that is that there's an exception in here that he can like give a perpetual vow to leave it into the hands of the priesthood or in the hands of the Levites. If he dedicates to he who is a field that he has bought, which is not part of his possession. So now this is a different thing. It's not part of his original inheritance. He has bought the leasing rights from somebody else. And then he passed that leasing on to the priesthood or to the Levites. Verse 23, then the priest shall calculate the amount of valuation for it up to the year of Jubilee, and the man shall give the valuation on the day as a holy gift to he who is. So same rules apply. Even though the property isn't technically his permanently, he has loaned it out to the priests, and if he wants to bring it back under his own control, he has to pay them what is appropriate, plus the 20%, in order to bring that back under his control. In the year of Jubilee, the field shall return to him from whom it is bought, to whom the land belongs as a possession. That's standard procedure. In the year of Jubilee, all land leases revert to the original inheritance line. This is one of the ways that God guaranteed that no one would lose their heritage in the Promised Land. And then a little housekeeping matter here. Every valuation shall be according to the shekel of the sanctuary. So the sanctuary shekel is the standard for all shekel weights. Remember, there's no coinage at this time, so it's just a matter of weight. 20 gerahs shall make a shekel. And so they knew what a gerah was, and 20 of those made a shekel for the sanctuary, and that became the standard for everyone. More than likely, what they do is that everybody would get a shekel weight that measured exactly the same as the shekel sanctuary. And that's what they used in all of their transactions, that standardized weight. And you see places in the Proverbs and elsewhere requiring that a standardized weight be used in all financial transactions. Verse 26, however, a firstborn of animals, which as a firstborn belongs to he who is, no man may dedicate. So you can't dedicate to God something that already belongs to Him. So every firstborn animal already belonged to God. So you couldn't, as a farmer, go, my cow's about to give birth to her first calf. I'm going to give that calf to God. You can't give to God what's already owed Him. A firstborn calf belongs to God automatically. That's the point. Now, verse 27, if it is an unclean animal, then he shall buy it back at a valuation and add a fifth to it, or if it's not redeemed, it shall be sold at the valuation. So a firstborn animal that's not a sacrificial animal, a person can buy that one back, even though it's firstborn, but he has to give 120% for it. If he doesn't want to keep it, but the priests don't want it, like a donkey or a camel, then it can be sold and the money given to the priesthood, but it has to be sold at its valuation. And, of course, the person has to add 20% to it when he kicks the money over to the priesthood. Verse number 28. No devoted thing that a man devotes to he who is, of anything that he has, whether man or beast, or of his inherited field, shall be sold or redeemed. Every devoted thing is most holy to he who is. But just a reminder, if it already belongs to God by right, you can't redeem it. No one devoted who is to be devoted for destruction from mankind shall be redeemed or ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. If something has come under a death penalty, then you can't redeem that unless it's specified in the law. For example, if your ox gores and kills that person you can't redeem your killer ox. That's not allowed. It's an automatic. They have to die. And so that's just kind of clearing up some things as we go through here. Every tithe of the land, remember, everybody owes 10% of their harvest, of their increase, to God's service. They'll give it to the Levites, and then the Levites will give a tenth of what they receive to the priesthood. That's the way the tithing system works. So every tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the trees, it is he who is. It is holy to he who is. So you have to give it to God. That's an automatic. It's a mandatory thing for the Jewish people. Now, there is the possibility of redeeming back a portion of that, but I'm going to remind you from something we saw earlier, it's going to only be because you feel bad that the randomizer of giving your tithe put some substandard things into the tithe basket. And if you, as a righteous person, go, no, I'm not giving that stuff to God, this is the rule that applies. If a man wishes to redeem some of his tithe, he shall add a fifth to it. So he can say, no, I want to put something else in there instead. Then, yeah, he can do that at 120% of value. Every tithe of the herds and the flocks, every tenth animal of all that pass under the herdsman's staff shall be holy to he who is. And this is the perfect example of what I was just talking about. The way that the tithe of animals was supposed to happen is, of course, all the firstborn already belong to God. Then you would run all your other animals through a little narrow area, and you would mark the first animal of every 10. This one belongs to the Lord. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. This one belongs to the Lord. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. This one belongs to the Lord. And so it's a randomized effect. Verse 33, one shall not differentiate between good or bad, neither shall he make a substitute for it. So when you're randomizing your animal stock as they're running through the little marker area, if you mark one of your best animals to go to the Lord, you can't go, hey, wait a second, I want that one back. I'll give a different one. No, that's not allowed. But if it marks like one that's looking pretty ragged and you go, no, I don't want to be giving God something like that, that's not right, then you may do a substitute on that one with this provision. Verse 33 continues. Neither shall he make a substitute for it, but if he does substitute for it, then both it and the substitute shall be holy. It shall not be redeemed. So you touch the bad animal with the marking staff, and you go, nah, I am not giving that animal. You can say, no, I'm going to give the next animal instead. And then you restart your count after that animal. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Next one belongs to the Lord. So that's the principle, is that you don't stiff God in regards to the best animals that might pass under the shepherd's staff, the marking staff. But you can give a better substitute to God for a poorly randomized animal, but God still gets that other animal too. Verse 34, these are the commandments that he who is commanded Moses for the people of Israel on Mount Sinai. And that, of course, is the end of the book of Numbers. The book of Leviticus, which is the rule book for Levites that we've spent some time in. We are now going to go back to the book of Numbers. We had already talked about some of the things after the Nazirite vow in earlier sessions. So we fast forward to Numbers chapter 10. Numbers chapter 10. And this is where we are now getting ready to leave Mount Sinai. Everything that we've been talking about had taken place in the first and second months of the second year of the Exodus. And so God had originally intended that the original itinerary was he would bring them out of Egypt at Passover in the first month of the first year of the Exodus. He brought them to Mount Sinai in time for the giving of the law at Pentecost, the third month of the year of the Exodus. And then Moses spent first 40 days and then another 40 days with God up on Mount Sinai. That takes us up to the sixth month of the first Jewish year. The rest of that year was spent in manufacturing the components of the tabernacle. And then on the first day of the first month of the second year, those components were all put together. The tabernacle was assembled for the first time. We spend 12 days going through the dedication of that whole tabernacle and all the celebrations that go with it. When the 14th day of that first month rolls around, they have their first anniversary Passover, and then they have from the 15th through the 21st, they have their first anniversary of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then in the beginning of the second month, God starts helping them understand how to rearrange the camp around this tabernacle in an appropriate way. The people that have got issues of uncleanness, they are moved outside the boundaries of the camp for either a short period of time or for a longer period of time. And all of that is stuff we've talked about. And now God wants the Israelis to get ready to leave Mount Sinai to go up to the southern border of the Promised Land, where he will take them in and help them get ready for the first year of planting in the Promised Land. That's the original schedule that God was working on. It's about to get screwed up because of the hard-heartedness of the Jewish people. But part of the preparation process is found here in Numbers chapter 10. He who is spoke to Moses, saying, make two silver trumpets. Now, we talk about ram's horn trumpets, shofar, shofarim, if you want to do the plural, I think, or it might be shofarot, but whatever it is, those are made of animal horns, ram's horns, and they get used in a lot of ceremonies. But for the purposes of the Exodus and the movement of the encampment of Israel, God wants two signal trumpets made, because trumpeting was the ancient means of communication over distance. The trumpets were basically the walkie-talkies or the radios or whatever other way you want to think of it to communicate between groups and between individuals of the ancient world. So God says to Moses, make two silver trumpets of hammered work, you shall make them, more than likely Bezalel and Aholiab are probably going to make these. You shall use them for summoning the congregation and for breaking camp. So they are for communication purposes. Now, why two? More than likely, it's not for volume, but rather for signal arrangement. One might have a slightly different, note or key than the other. And so you can tell the difference between them when they are trumpeted, or possibly they are harmonized because of that, so that when they're sounded separately, you can distinguish from when they're being played together. Certainly, the rapidity or the number of blasts or the spacing between the blasts, like a Morse code sort of thing, all of that is the possibilities of communication by these trumpets. But the point is, everybody's going to hear it and know what it means. I was in the military, and even in this time of modern communication devices, we still use certain trumpet sounds and signals for certain events, like reveille to wake up in the morning, or taps to have retreat of the flag, to pull the flag down at the end of day. You know just by the first few notes what's being played, and you know what event is happening. So that's the idea of what's happening here with these trumpets. Verse number 3, when both are blown, all the congregation shall gather themselves to you at the entrance of the tent of meeting. So if it's maybe that harmonized event, people go, oh, it's the double trumpet. Everybody's expected to show up at the front of the tabernacle. Verse number 4, if they blow only one, then the chiefs, the heads of the tribes of Israel, shall gather themselves to you. So, oh, that's only one trumpet. That means only the big guys have to go. When you blow an alarm, now when we hear the word alarm, we think that there's something scary going on, something dangerous. But that's not what is meant by here. It's got something to do with the signal, the meaning of the signal. When you blow an alarm, the camps that are on the east side shall set out. So this is the idea of breaking camp. We know that the presence of God lifts up off the tabernacle. Apparently, the night before, that is after sunset, if the presence of God lifts up and moves away from the tabernacle, everybody understands, hey, tomorrow morning, we're moving. And so when the first signal trumpet blows, then the people who are encamped on the east side, that'd be the Judah tribe and its associated two tribes, they know it's time for them to follow the presence of God on the march. When you blow the alarm a second time, the camps that are on the south side shall set out. An alarm is to be blown when they are set out. When the assembly is gathered together, you shall blow a long blast, but you shall not sound an alarm. Again, there's some sort of distinguishing characteristics between these trumpet sounds. The sons of Aaron, the priest, shall blow the trumpets. So the priests are in control of these two signal trumpets. The trumpets shall be for you for a perpetual statute throughout your generations. And so these signal trumpets are supposed to continue perpetually. When you go to war in your land against the adversary who opposes you, then you shall sound an alarm with the trumpets, that you may be remembered before he who is your God, and you shall be saved from your enemies. So apparently they had some sort of charge trumpeting signal whenever they went against the enemy. And they did that in the name of he who is. And then for special occasions, on the day of your gladness also, at your appointed feasts, at the beginning of your months. So every first day of the month in the evening when the sun went down and the crescent moon was there, then they blew the trumpet. And you shall blow your trumpets over your burnt offerings and over your sacrifices and peace offerings. They shall be a reminder of you before your God. I am he who is your God.